invented first grade? I mean, or second or third grade for that matter. I mean, someone had to. Someone had to decide that it was a good idea to put all the kids of the same age in one room and have a person teach them for a year before passing them on. But why? Today, the story of the rise and fall of a school system from the past that did things completely differently, why almost nobody has heard of it today, and what we have to learn from this almost forgotten experiment. This is the story of Andrew Bell and his Madras schools. You are listening to I Heart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. You know, if I didn't have to do so many worksheets and poster projects, I could actually be learning something. That's what my daughter Eva said when I asked her how one of her high school classes was going. Now, there are definitely kids who show off how bored they are in high school because they're so much more advanced than those juvenile high school classes. But Eva wasn't showing off or complaining. I've never once heard her speak ill of a classmate or a teacher. Eva is just curious. She really just loves to learn. The classes that she likes best are the ones where she says she can feel herself learning. She knows that's what school is for. And when she gets frustrated by school, it is because school falls short of that promise. Like, a lot. That happens because school isn't really made for Eva. I mean, it's not really made for any kid in particular. It's made for another kid, a hypothetical kid, a kid who isn't quite so curious and motivated, a kid who mostly sees learning as work and who needs grades as an incentive to get it done, and a kid who, because they're not really asking their own questions, needs a teacher to ask for them and then needs like these highly structured assignments to funnel their energy toward an answer. There's nothing wrong with being that kind of kid or making a school for that kind of kid. It's just not who Eva is. And I'm sure you know, she's not the only one. I've spent my life on the other side of the worksheet as a teacher, and I've watched kids like Eva politely sitting through class, feeling like the pace was ponderously slow. For these kids, school actually seems to slow down their learning. Like, if these kids had played hooky in the library, they could have and probably would have learned more. And frankly, it's a lot of kids. By my very unscientific measurement, I'd say it's about one kid in five. This was as frustrating for me as a teacher as it was for my students. I wished I could have loosened the criteria, increased the challenge, or picked up the pace. But that was really hard to do. Because sitting right next to the Evas of the world, in the same classes, were a whole bunch of students who were actually very similar to the hypothetical student that school actually was built for. Ones who really did better at that steady pace, with highly constrained assignments, and all those built-in incentives for getting the work done. And what made it hardest of all was that there were also a whole bunch of students in nearly the opposite circumstances, Eva. Students for whom the learning felt insurmountable and for whom the pace felt blistering. Sometimes it's because their nervous system just worked differently than the average person in a way that made it hard for them to read or remember stuff or concentrate like other people. And sometimes it was just because somewhere along the line they had missed something, something critical in the early stages and fallen behind. And sometimes it was because there were hard things happening outside of school, which meant they couldn't sleep. Or couldn't do homework. Whatever the reason, school had measured them and found them wanting, and they knew it. I have had 10th graders reading with the same fluency as the average 3rd or 4th grade kid, and those kids were way more frustrated than Eva. It's hard to want to learn when the very institution that is supposed to help you do it constantly sends you the message that you suck at it. And this, for a teacher who deeply cares about learning, is the most frustrating and heartbreaking thing of all. Teaching, at least for me, was impossible. I'm fairly certain that I was a pretty good teacher, but it almost killed me. It consumed almost every waking moment of my life and had me working every weekend and well into the night. It once prompted my wife to tell me that if I didn't go into therapy, she was going to have to. So when educational reformers came in and suggested that the solution to this problem is that teachers should differentiate by having several different versions of every lesson tailored to their various levels, backgrounds, and abilities, well, let's just say I didn't feel seen or respected. I mean, what? Do you think that if I had the capacity to do that, I wouldn't have done it already? The problem wasn't the students, but it wasn't the teachers either. Most of us were doing the best we could at a Herculean job. The problem was school itself. The way I saw it, the modern institution of school, pretty much all over the world, is set up like an assembly line. The raw materials are some 5-year-old kids. We put them onto the conveyor belt in kindergarten, and then about 13 years later, they come out the other end of the factory. I mean, the school. Supposedly, as a fully functioning economic widget. Except when they don't. And sometimes, even when they do, they feel like that assembly line has held them back. But why? Why is school that way? And can we somehow change it? Those are the questions that I set out to answer when I began researching this essay. And what I found not only surprised me, but it changed the very questions I was asking. The truth is that schools don't have to be this way. And the world may have forgotten this, but they almost weren't. The enterprise of modern education almost began on a completely different set of principles, and the story of how that path was forsaken, or at least my understanding of it, has profound implications for Eva, for me, for teachers, for students all over the world. So today, I want to tell you that story. The year was 1789. The place was British colonial India. An Anglican priest named Andrew Bell had recently arrived in the city of Madras, now Chennai. Bell was an entertaining speaker who had studied all the latest science, and he had made a name for himself as a lecturer, demonstrating things like electricity and hot air balloons and artificial ice. He was kind of a local 18th century Bill Nye. He also became chaplain for several regiments of the British Army, a pretty cushy job with very few responsibilities and a generous paycheck. Bell was an ambitious and energetic man. In 1789, he took on yet another job, superintendent of an orphanage. This orphanage was called the Male Orphan Asylum, and it was run by the East India Company out of a crumbling old military fort. When Bell arrived, he found the 20 or so orphans housed there, underclothed, underfed, and infected with parasites and measles. Those orphans were not necessarily there voluntarily. They were the children of Indian women and British soldiers. British soldiers as fathers who either couldn't or wouldn't support them. These boys were often forcibly removed from their Indian families. Now, whatever complicity Bell had in this traumatic family separation, by all accounts, he cared deeply and genuinely for his boys once they were in his keeping. He even turned down the salary the East India Company offered him. And under him, the orphanage expanded rapidly. First, he addressed the most pressing needs: hygiene, nutritious meals, clean bedding, adequate clothes, inoculation against smallpox. But once these were sorted, he turned his attention to schooling. As you might expect, the orphanage ran on a shoestring. Other than Bell, who technically was a volunteer, it only had 3 employees, a headmaster and 2 assistant teachers. And Bell thought that they were absolutely terrible teachers. He tried to hire better ones, but whenever he did, they would leave for better-paying jobs elsewhere. The ones who stayed, he deemed totally incompetent, and eventually, they were badly outnumbered. The orphanage grew to about 200 boys. That's a class of 100 for each supposedly abysmal teacher. Bell was ruminating on this problem one morning on a thoughtful horseback ride along the beach, when he encountered a group of children scratching in the sand. Upon closer inspection, he saw that they were scratching letters. The older children were teaching the younger ones to read and write. Bell probably had no idea, but he had stumbled into a traditional open-air temple school. But whether he did or not, this simple observation inspired him to revelation. In an Archimedes-like moment of eureka, he turned his horse back to the asylum at a gallop. And immediately, Bell upended the orphan school. Instead of workbooks, which the orphanage couldn't afford anyway, he gave his youngest students trays of wet sand. Now they had a cheap, erasable, endlessly reusable surface to practice their letters on, just like the kids at the beach. But more importantly, Bell saw how to solve his staffing problem. Bell recruited his best students. He and his teachers trained them to be tutors, and then sent them out to work with the novices. His idea was that the school would teach itself. To the modern ear, this might sound preposterous, but it worked. It eventually became a whole system of instruction. Bell organized the boys into different classes, not by age, which wouldn't make any sense since boys at all different ages were at all different levels. Some 12-year-olds couldn't read at all, while some 9-year-olds could. So instead, Bell organized them by how much reading or writing they could already do. In each class, a skilled boy became the teacher, and he taught the other boys what he'd already learned, but what they hadn't yet. As a student mastered the skill, they would take over the class, and the old teacher got to graduate into the next level. This was no assembly line. The boys advanced at their own pace, they got to work on skills as long as it took them to master them, and it got them to progress as quickly as they were able, provided that they shared what they knew along the way. We know a lot more about how people learn than people did in the 1700s, and a lot of the success of Bell's system makes sense in terms of what we know now. And sometimes it succeeded at several things that our modern schools often fail at. Here's a couple examples. Number one, Bell noticed that tutors actually got a lot out of teaching. Today, we would say that it forced them to more actively process their new knowledge. This led them to better consolidate the knowledge in their long-term memories, and it gave them the kind of unpredictable practice that helped them to transfer their knowledge to new situations. It turns out that trying to explain something so clearly that it makes sense to a novice is one of the best ways to understand difficult ideas yourself. Today, cognitive scientists and YouTube productivity influencers both advocate for this study technique, often called the Feynman technique, after the Nobel Prize-winning physicist. Second, Bell noticed that the frequent, low-stakes opportunities to advance were highly motivating. It was like levels in a video game. Becoming a tutor was a point of pride, a visible symbol that one had accomplished something worthy of esteem. Third, Bell also noticed something that wouldn't really be taken seriously in educational circles for another two centuries. Boys who had just mastered something were often better at explaining the skill than expert adults were. Nowadays, people often call this the curse of knowledge. Basically, what it means is that when you're an expert, it's hard to remember the difficulties in what you've already learned. Fourth, and most importantly, the flexible pacing meant that nobody had to flounder in a class that was way over their head. In today's world, so used to the educational assembly line, being held back a grade is such a scarlet letter of shame that many schools won't even do it anymore. But in Bell's school, there was little stigma. All the classes were mixed age. Everyone could move at their own pace without embarrassment. Whatever the causes, Bell's experiments in schooling were a success. So much so that people from the local mothers to British officers were begging him to admit their kids. This, he wrote, I consider as the best commendation of the asylum. After 7 years in India, Bell's health began to decline and he returned home to convalesce. He planned to go back to India, but he never did. Instead, he wrote with zeal about his experiments in education. He had 1,000 copies of his book printed and passed them out to everyone he could. He must have been persuasive because Madras-style schools spread all over Britain. At the time, school was a privilege, available only to the wealthy. About 10% of children regularly attended school, but there was a growing sentiment in philanthropic and religious circles that this ought to change. And in Bell's cost-effective approach, they saw education's future. powerful charitable organizations took up the approach and spread it throughout the empire, Canada, the Caribbean, South Africa, the Pacific. And his colleague and rival, a man named Joseph Lancaster, spread something similar through the Americas, including the United States. At its height in the 1830s, it seemed as if Bell's approach might be the future of education. But as you and I know, that wasn't the case. Why not? What happened to all those schools? Why did we end up with the conveyor belt instead? Why is it that hardly anyone has heard of Bell or his schools today? The truth is, it's complicated. And as I researched this episode, what I discovered surprised me. Surprised me so much that it has actually changed my whole conception of what the factory model of schools really is. In 1837, a few years after Bell's death, a state senator named Horace Mann was appointed to become the first Secretary of Education in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was already one of the best educated places in the world. Its Protestant founders had strongly believed that everyone should be able to read the Bible for themselves. So pretty much every community for the past 200 years had supported a school that taught basic reading and writing and arithmetic. Horace was an abolitionist and a reformer. The idea that everybody can and should go to school was generations away, but Horace was one of the first proponents, and whether he intended to or not, he would influence the trajectory of free education, not just for Massachusetts, but for the entire world. Mann went and physically visited every single school in the state. Then he also traveled to Europe to tour schools there, and was particularly impressed with the national free school system in the Kingdom of Prussia. Under Horace's leadership, a system of universal, tuition-free, taxpayer-funded, co-ed public schools opened and then became compulsory in the state by 1852. To provide the necessary workforce, he established a system of teacher training institutions called normal schools to train women, and pretty much just women, to be teachers. Like the Prussian schools he admired, these schools would be secular, but still, of course, steeped in good Protestant morality, and monitored to allow a good degree of control to ensure that young minds were being correctly molded. In a popular TED talk on this subject, Sir Ken Robinson describes the schooling that Mann championed, even if he didn't attribute it to him in particular. And in this model, the school is like a factory. The workers were the teachers standing in one place, one classroom, as the product, the student, came down the conveyor belt ready to be stamped with the particular bits of knowledge prescribed for a given grade. That's the popular origin story of factory-style education. But here's where it got really surprising to me. In trying to figure out what happened to the system that Bell invented, I learned that Horace Mann knew about Bell's approach. Schools like Bell's were widespread and had been energetically implemented in New York and Philadelphia. And while Horace admired some things about them, he rejected the approach because, get this, they were too factory-like. That's right. Mann and the reformers of his day thought that the schools run by Bell and Lancaster relied too much on rote memorization and were too regimented, and they were worried that while they might teach certain skills, they wouldn't really teach kids to think. What the heck? When I began to read these critiques, I realized something was up with my understanding about the whole history of how schools went down. And as I dug deeper, I saw that Mann and company had a point. The schools that Joseph Lancaster had set up were mostly held in actual warehouses. They literally were factories. The curriculum was rigid, the outcomes were not as rosy as advertised, and it turned out that if you could afford it, having the help of an expert teacher really was better than having to rely on your peers alone. And in Lancaster's system, the discipline was downright abusive. Bell had been adamantly opposed to corporal punishment. He had been traumatized by harsh punishments he himself had endured as a student. But Lancaster seemed to delight in sadistic creativity. The more I read of Mann's writing, the less I was able to justify thinking that he'd intended to set up a school based on a factory model. He didn't intend for schools to look like an assembly line at all. In fact, the assembly line really wouldn't be invented for another 80 to 100 years. Mostly what he wanted was to spread the idea that everyone should get to go to school. And in order to put well-trained, highly qualified teachers in every classroom, there had to be some kind of structure. If he ended up making a different kind of educational factory, it seems to have been by accident. And if people were excited about the industrial aspects of this kind of school, well, it wasn't so far off from the squeals of delight from modern tech bros about Chromebooks in the classroom or video games that teach math. Just like today, people wanted to automate menial tasks to free up teachers for the real work of deep learning. Streamline education enough, and you could bring it affordably to everyone, in the same way that factories had made clothes that everyone could afford. And they were right. Packaging education into grade levels and classrooms brought school to almost every child in every country in the world. For all their flaws, these factory schools taught the world to read. This is not where I expected this episode to go. When I started researching, I thought I'd figure out where assembly line schools came from, and now I'm not sure they really came from anywhere. Instead of a conspiracy to train children to comply, I found ongoing debates about what school was for and how much of it people could afford to provide. Even before public schools were a thing, people were arguing about what they should be like. Yeah, there was plenty of racist bullshit, like our schools should make sure that those dirty immigrants embrace Anglo-American culture. And other people wanted to make sure that even in secular schools, everyone got steeped in Protestant Christian values, a move that really ticked off the Catholics who decided to open their own system of schools. Some people did want to mold a compliant workforce. But there were plenty of others who wanted to develop a spirit of free inquiry and democratic ideals. None of this should have been surprising to me. You can find people who want all of these things today. The way I understand it now, the school system has never really been one big thing. Right from the beginning, people experimented. From Bell's Madras system to Mann's common schools, from Catholic schools to the one-room village schoolhouse, everywhere, people tried to solve problems they had with the resources they had, just as they did in every other human endeavor. But the thing is, the critique that started this essay still stands in my mind. In most of today's schools, some students are trammeled as their age-level grade leaves them in the dust. And some, like Eva, are held back. Those complaints are real, and the structures of school that we've inherited really do perpetuate them. In my lifetime, and in my country, I think that this problem has contributed to this sense that there's something wrong with our schools, that they are failing, that they are broken, that kids are being left behind. And while this is true, my looking back in history for this essay made it obvious to me that this is nothing new. Schools have always left kids behind, often on purpose. Lots of kids weren't even allowed in school because they weren't white or because they weren't boys. But even in school, kids got left behind because teachers didn't know that dyslexia or ADHD were a thing, much less how to help students with them. Even in my parents' generation, nobody accommodated learning disabilities or differences. If you had one, you just struggled through. And even for neurotypical white boys, if you weren't good at recitations or learning from lectures, you were out of luck, because that was pretty much all they had. And it's not true that more kids slip through the crack these days. What is true is that these days we're less tolerant of it. We've raised the bar on what schools are supposed to do. These days, finally, we're asking schools to teach all the things to every single kid. Schools are not broken. We're just asking them to do something they've never had to do before. And that's hard. and it's easy to understand why they aren't there yet. But damn, look at the progress we've made. First, schools treat kids a lot more like human beings. They used to hit kids on a regular basis, and they don't hit kids anymore. And students have rights to expression and due process protected by the courts. Our punishments are less severe, and our consequences are more constructive than they have ever been. Second, schools are way more fair. In the 1990s, for the first time in history, women graduated college at the same rate as men. However much Eva gets frustrated by busy work, she never complains about colleges or fields of study that are off limits to her because she's a girl. She just assumes that education is her right. Thank you, Title IX. And actually, right now, educational attainment among women has outpaced that of men so much that we are in the unique position of having to think about removing educational barriers for them. While the gap in educational outcomes between races is much more stubborn, even there, significant progress has been made since the 1970s. For generations, we assumed that people would always fall off the educational conveyor belt. Some kids just didn't have the smarts, we guessed. So instead, schools spent a great deal of time trying to sort the haves from the have-nots. They fast-tracked some kids to the honors classes and sent them off to college, and let others serve out their time in remedial ones. Schools became a kind of sorting machine. But even that is changing these days. Now, when schools find struggling kids, they pour tons of energy into helping them get back on track. We haven't figured out how to do it all the time, but we are trying. We have laws that demand that schools accommodate kids with disabilities. We have teachers whose whole job is to identify kids that need extra help, give it to them, and then send them on their way all caught up. In my job now, I have seen schools take middle school kids whose learning disabilities are so severe that even with daily, intensive instruction, they're reading at a fourth grade level. But those teachers continue to patiently, lovingly, and expertly push them forward and make real gains. I know of one kid who in middle school is reading at a normally fluent rate for the first time in her life. These are kids who, even a few decades ago, would have been written off as unhelpable. These schools and these teachers are changing that kid's life. Across every expectation, schools have risen. From a time when it was a privilege just to go to school, and where most kids barely learned to do a cursory job of reading and writing, we've come to a time when 90% graduate high school. 13 years of schooling that includes much more. 40% of Americans have college degrees. And right now, we're not worried that most people have access to school. We're just worried about how good that school is. I'd say that's a much better problem to have. I love the story of Andrew Bell's Madras schools because it reminds me that schools aren't stuck in an industrial model, and they never were. They've been innovating from the beginning, and they're innovating now more than ever, and they have made enormous progress. If schools were a conveyor belt, it's because that's what we could manage at the time. But they are looking less and less like that. They are retooling and sometimes completely ditching the assembly line all the time. For her part, Eva is doing an independent study next semester on clothing in medieval Europe. And last summer, with the blessing and assistance of the math department, she learned plane geometry on her own so that she could move ahead. Neither of these things would have been available in my high school in the early 1990s. Eva is the beneficiary of a growing flexibility in our schools. That progress may be too slow for my taste, and it may not be linear, but looking back, I see that schools are the best they've ever been for the greatest number of kids. If we, rightly, dream of going farther, it's because we've been emboldened by how far we've already come. Hey friends, if you've enjoyed this episode of I Heart This, would you do one small thing to support it? Go to our YouTube channel, the link is in the show notes, and just click the subscribe button. That's it. Even if you never watch or listen to any of our videos on YouTube, and even if you never return to our YouTube page, your little click will feed the algorithm that helps other people to find us. Each episode of I Heart This takes between 25 and 75 hours to produce. You can help make that work matter in just 25 seconds. And thank you. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Email us at ben@iheartthispodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.